Case number 06-7148, Milton Mills, M.D., et al., appellants versus Giant of Maryland, LLC, et al. Mr. Ken Byrne for the appellants, Ms. Rosenbaum for the appellees.
I'd like to start by talking about lactose intolerance and how it develops. Every mammal, whether you're a human or a dog or a whale or an elephant, all babies of mammals are born with the enzyme that allows them to digest their mother's milk. And that is universal throughout all mammals. And of course, our genes, which work in mysterious ways, know over time, mammals stop drinking their mother's milk, and they all go on to eat the foods that the adults of their species eat. So whales go on to eat krill, and elephants go on to eat grass, and humans go on to eat solid foods. So for mammals generally, and for humans specifically, over time, your genes turn off the ability to make the enzyme that allows infants to digest their mother's milk. And so the normal genetic pattern for most human beings on this planet is that as they age, they lose the ability to drink their mother's milk. And if they continue to do so beyond the normal age of weaning, they start to get sick. And that sickness develops over time because your genes don't just shut off, you know, on one day. This is a process. It's different in every person, and it's different across races of people. Because some races, the Caucasian race specifically, over many generations trained itself, these are mostly Northern Europeans, who over time got a lot of their protein over the winter from cattle and from cattle milk. And so their genes mutated over time to allow the adults to continue to absorb this food without the illness. So in a minority of the world population and in a minority of the DC population are able as adults to drink cow's milk without getting sick. But for most people and for most DC residents, you know, you sit at home and your mother makes you a nice meal and she says, finish your milk because it'll make you grow strong. It'll help you get good bones. So you drink your milk at home. And for years, you go along and you're drinking your milk and you're eating the other things that your mother puts before you and you're doing fine. You're growing, you're happy. But then over time, you know, you're sitting in school as a kid and your stomach's grumbling and you've got gas and you have to go to the bathroom a lot and it's a problem. And you're, you know, as a kid, you don't know what it is. You know, this stuff happens. It's just part of human experience that sometimes your stomach gets upset. And as a kid, of course, you don't know what it is or why it's happening. And of course, for most adults, even if the child comes home and says, Mom, you know, I felt crummy today. I was in the bathroom 6 times in school. I had to keep getting up and asking the teacher to go to the bathroom. And the mother's going to say, gee, you know, I guess it must be a bug or, you know, maybe it was something you ate. And of course, it was something they ate. It was the cow's milk that the mother was feeding the child. And so what happens is that it doesn't happen at a set time, and it doesn't happen in a set way. So the fact is that children don't expect it, and it doesn't always happen in childhood. It sometimes happens in adulthood. You go through your entire childhood drinking cow's milk and thinking it's fine and being told by the government and the dairy industry that this is good for you, but it's slowly, over time, your body loses the ability to digest it, and it starts to make you sick. And the more milk you have and the more you ingest, the sicker you get. So that seems to me to take us right into the safety exemption over the preemption issue. Because if the record allows this court to determine that a finder of fact could determine that the health risks of lactose intolerance constitute something that a state might conclude, or the FDA might conclude, is a safety issue, then the preemption issue does not exist. Because the Congress has said that we will not preempt the states from putting safety warnings on products, on food products. And that is a decision that Congress made. And so the issue then is the district court was faced with a record. And on the record, we showed the court that there was...
I back up for just 1 second. Leaving aside the safety, what you describe as a safety exception, although the statute doesn't call it an exception, it calls it a construction of the
right.
statute. Does this come within A1 in the first place? That is this... I took it that there was an argument that this is not a requirement about identity.
And well, that's
it's not
right.
a requirement about identity. We don't even have to get to the safety question on preemption. Is that right or wrong?
That's right. And I think that goes to the heart of the mistake that was made by the defendants here. If you look at the standard of identity, the 21 U.S.C. Section 341.
Right. About, I want to get even before we get. I'm having difficulty figuring out whether this is correct or not correct by reading the words of the statute. So it could be that it's any requirement for a food which is the subject of a standard of identity, right? And there's no question that milk is a subject of a standard of identity.
Correct.
And this is a requirement. And you can't have a requirement that's not identical to the requirement in 343G, period.
Right, but well, it's
one
either
way to,
one
I
or
think
two.
That's one way to read. Well, two is
because
not.
Because two talks to labeling directly. That's any requirement for the labeling of the food. And I would think that we would look to that.
What's any requirement for the labeling of a food required by Section 343C, which is about imitation, and 343E, which is about packaging?
Right, none of which apply.
None of which apply, but so therefore this might not be a requirement about imitation or labeling, and
exactly.
therefore not relevant either.
Exactly. I think that is the easiest way to approach this, because it is, if you look at two, none of those requirements apply here. So two is out altogether. So then we're left with one. I think that's what Your Honor was getting at.
What I'm trying to get at is I don't understand the statute, and I don't actually have a view. I'm trying to figure out what the right view is. If you read two, you could say that you can't have any requirement for labeling that isn't identical to requirements about imitation and packaging.
Right.
And this is not identical to
no,
those,
obviously.
And therefore you're preempted. You could say that. Is there any way to figure out what this means? Is there anything in the legislative history? Is there anything in another opinion of a court of appeals or the Supreme Court which
well,
addresses this?
I think it's easier than that, because I think it goes to, you start with 341, because 341 is the statute that sets out what is a standard of identity for food. What is the concept of it? So before I get to the text, let's talk about the concept. The idea is you walk into your supermarket and you go up to the dairy aisle and there's a container that says milk. You want to be able to pick that up, and Congress wanted you to be able to pick that up and know that that was A, cow's milk, B, that it was all cow's milk. It wasn't partly cow's milk and partly water and partly soy filler or whatever else. They wanted a consumer to know, and this is what 341 is all about. 341 says, if you're going to call it milk and put it on the shelves of the stores and ship it in interstate commerce, if you call it milk, it must be cow's milk from a healthy cow. Well, I mean, this was a broad. 341 is the statute that lays out the standard of identity for all foods that the FDA chooses.
I understand your argument. I think what Judge Garland is saying, and I agree with him, the statute is rather ambiguous. Is there any interpretation of the statute which the FDA has come up with on this question? Or any government agency with authority to interpret it?
No, I don't believe anybody was able to find a case that does that. But in terms of looking at, you're looking at a narrow issue, which is there is a labeling portion of Section 341, but it's very limited. It says, 341 starts. It says, whenever in the judgment of the secretary such action will promote honesty and fair dealing, he shall promote regulations fixing and establishing for any food under its common and usual name a reasonable definition and standard of identity, quality, and fill. Then it goes on at the end to say, in prescribing a definition, the secretary shall, for the purpose of promoting honesty and fair dealing in the interests of consumers, designate the optional ingredients which shall be named on the label. So the secretary did that. The FDA said, you're right, we need to establish a standard of identity for milk. And it says milk is the lacteal secretion, blah, 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 from a healthy cow. And then it says nomenclature. The name of the food is milk. The name of the food shall be accompanied by a declaration indicating the presence of any flavoring. What does that mean? If it's chocolate milk, it's got to say chocolate milk. Can't pick up a bottle of milk that says milk and it can't have chocolate in it. They got to tell you that. If vitamins are added, if you're going to put in vitamin A, you got to say it.
I'm just a little concerned about your time. And I'm anxious to get you to go to the second issue in the case, if you could, which is the general tort theory.
Okay. Let me talk about the cause of action. It seems to me it parallels with the safety issue, because the record before the district court was that this is a condition.
Is it fair to say the restatement of torts is not hospitable to your cause of action?
No, I don't think that's right, because I think the problem the district court had was to get over the idea that everybody knows what milk is. Of course everyone knows what milk is. And he equated that to diabetes, a diabetic knowing what sugar is, and someone with a peanut allergy knowing what a peanut is. The problem is those allergies affect you in different ways. You don't miss that you have diabetes. If you have juvenile diabetes and you eat sugar, you go into a coma. You don't miss that. It occurs immediately. Same thing with peanut allergies. If you give a child...
That's not true. People develop peanut allergies at various stages in their life and without warning.
That's right. But once you have it, this is the distinction. When you have a peanut allergy, once it's developed, and you eat something with a peanut, boom, you go into anaphylactic shock, and you don't miss the fact that you had a reaction to what you just ate. This is a different reaction. Lactose intolerance does not happen the minute you finish drinking the milk, as it would.
So what is the warning going to give you? What will be the consequence of having a warning?
The consequence of the warning is when a child comes back from school, uh-huh, or an adult who's been drinking milk all their lives and who suddenly is constantly running to the bathroom, constantly got gas, constantly feeling sick, when they go and pick up the container of milk, they're going, oh my God, that's what I have. That's what I have. And the point is...
Then what will they do?
They'll go to their doctor.
Okay, so that means the symptoms have not been strong enough to cause them to go to the doctor in the first place?
Sometimes they have. Not every doctor diagnoses it correctly. It's a very...
The fact that it's listed on a generic bottle of milk that intolerance might cause this, it's not going to cause a doctor to give a different diagnosis.
Well, actually it does. I mean, we had one of our plaintiffs ended up getting a colonoscopy. Now, a colonoscopy is not a diagnostic test for lactose intolerance. The fact is these kind of stomach symptoms...
Well, I'm asking you, it seems to me you have one group of plaintiffs or of people whose symptoms are not bad enough to cause them to go to the doctor and ask the doctor what's the matter.
No, I disagree with that, Judge.
So every one of these people has gone to the doctor to ask what was the matter?
No. What I'm saying is, Judge, for a lot of different reasons, people with very serious diseases do not go to the doctor, for a lot of reasons. Uninsured people with cancer don't go to the doctor.
And seeing
uninsured people with type 2 diabetes don't go to the
enough.
Doctor.
But seeing on the milk carton that this may be a cause... will cause them to go to the doctor?
Your Honor, I think you're jumping to remedy when we are at the beginning stage of the lawsuit.
Well, you've listed specifically the remedy you want, so I don't think I'm really jumping to it. I'm trying to figure out how serious a harm this is based on the kind of remedy that you seek?
I think that goes to the heart of the mistake that the district court made, was not to have scientific testimony about just the issue you're talking about. How serious is this condition? How many people really don't know about it?
Back to the sharp distinction you draw between this and peanuts.
Right.
There is no requirement that there be a warning on peanuts.
Well, I think the FDA has looked at the issue and concluded that it's unnecessary except when peanuts are in something you wouldn't think to find them in.
You just buy plain peanuts.
Peanuts, there's no warning, and we would agree with that.
Now, isn't it quite possible that you could have a mild form of peanut allergy?
I'm not a doctor, Judge, so I don't know how.
Let's assume hypothetically that's true. I mean, that's.
I think that if you look at FDA's.
Your concern, I gather. You would have a different position if lactose intolerance people, when they drank milk, fell down on the floor
right. And
threw up.
Right, because if
is that your point?
Yes. If there was
a violent reaction.
An immediate violent reaction, then obviously then you would be in a situation like with peanut allergy and like with other severe allergies.
Except that you assume that whether peanut allergy or a mild case of diabetes, you could have a mild response to sugar or a mild response to peanuts.
But the point is we're talking about this in the abstract, and we're not talking about it after hearing scientific testimony and medical testimony about the realities of the condition, to what extent the public doesn't know about it.
Well, I'm looking at restatement of law. We have to look at
right.
D.C. law here.
We don't have
a specific case. We look at restatement of law.
Right.
And the restatement, as I read it, does not require a warning unless there's a element that would not in the food that would not be otherwise known, as in your example of a peanut stuck in a chocolate bar.
An element, or that the condition itself, the restatement includes the possibility that if the condition itself is one that the reasonable consumer would not know and would not anticipate, that is also subject to liability under the restatement. So it seems to me that we have alleged that this particular condition, because of the particular way it develops over time, is a trap for the unwary.
Has any court held that there's a duty to warn in this kind of case in the United States?
No, it has not.
So
but we think this condition...
I think you may be wrong. There's one case you have that may support you.
Okay.
The Kentucky case on oysters. Sounds like it's similar to you. But
I think...
Court of Appeals. It's not a Supreme Court case.
Right, and it's certainly not binding on this court.
That's true. But that's the only case I could find that supports your proposition.
We think this condition is different from all the other allergies, because most allergies that trigger...
Excuse me. When you say that it's different, your position is that if a food could cause hundreds of thousands of people to drop dead, no warning is required. But if a food only causes a stomach ache, a warning is required?
No, Your Honor. It goes to the issue of what a reasonable consumer would understand. A reasonable consumer understands that if he eats Big Mac after Big Mac after Big Mac, bad things are going to happen. He may not understand the exact mechanism of cholesterol and heart attack and diabetes and stroke. But nonetheless, everybody understands that eating a diet of Big Macs is not a good diet. Milk is sold a different way, and there are different expectations in consumers about it, because the dairy industry and the federal government have jointly campaigned to convince people that dairy is safe and necessary.
I understand that argument, but that's not what I'm asking you. I'm asking you about the difference between something that causes a serious allergic response and something that causes a less serious one.
I think it goes to the issue of what a reasonable consumer would know about rather than the seriousness of the condition.
Well, in the peanut allergy, for example, you've never had a peanut before.
Right.
Right? So you don't know you're allergic.
Right.
But peanuts do cause anaphylactic shock and death for some people. Are you agreeing that no notice is required on peanuts,
yes,
that if you have a peanut allergy, you shouldn't take this?
Well, there are two
why
well, yes,
is,
I agree,
why
there's
is,
no warning.
I don't understand why you agree. Why is it that if you don't know about the allergy, but the allergy can kill you, no notice is required? But if you don't know about the allergy, and the allergy can only cause serious stomach ache, you do have to have a warning.
The issue is not your personal knowledge. The issue is the knowledge of the reasonable consumer, because the dairy industry cannot be expected to cater to every completely ignorant person who doesn't know anything about peanut allergies, which are widely understood, and all these schools are changing their policies because of peanut allergies. So peanut allergies is something that is well understood, as are other kinds of allergies. This is an allergy, until the mid-60s, lactose intolerance was thought to be this extremely rare condition that only some tiny minority suffered from. Only after they started studying African-American populations and Asian populations and Native American populations did they realize over time that a majority of the world is lactose intolerant. We have pled that this is a condition that is not well understood. The dairy industry and the federal government understand that.
We have your argument. Thank you. I think we've let you go way
Thank you.
Over. Thanks. We'll hear from the defendant.
May it please the court, I would like to start with the question of legal duty, which the your honors asked questions about. It's fair to say that milk has been consumed in this country since I think 1611, when it first the first milk cows arrived in the Jamestown colony. In the 400 years since, no court has ever found a legal duty to warn about the consequences of milk consumption. Indeed, the case is far stronger than that. In those 400 years or any 400 years.
Well, it's only the risk has only recently become known.
Well, according to.
I don't know. It helps to talk about 400 years.
Well, let's look at more broadly, though, with respect to food in general. There is no court in 400 years that has found there is a common law duty to warn about the consequences of being exposed to an inherent natural component of any food.
What about the oyster case?
Bacterium. It was that case turned on the fact that the oysters were contaminated with a bacterium that could cause serious illness.
No, it turned on the proposition that all oysters have some bacteria.
And that's
it wasn't these specific oysters.
Well, the contention was that in fact the illness was no. I believe it was that there was a potential for bacterium
it wasn't
in oysters.
An element. It wasn't a separate. Yes, it was a potential. Yes, there was a potential problem with all oysters, right?
Oysters. Well, in the sense that you might say any food could be spoiled and go bad, but
struck me is it exactly the same hypothetical as the
I don't.
Maybe wrongly decided it, but it struck me as pretty similar.
I don't think it's similar, Your Honor, because
what's different about it?
Because it was a case in which there was a contaminant in the product. The contaminant was the bacterium.
Presence occurs naturally under commonly occurring conditions, and screening is not feasible.
But it was.
Wait, did you hear? It's natural. Oysters have bacteria.
Lactose is a component of milk. It is part of milk. The bacterium is a condition that can develop with respect to the oysters,
wait
but
minute,
it is not.
Wait a minute. I'm not a scientist. But every item in the world, every animate item has bacteria, including us.
Well, but this was, as I understand the decision, there is a potential for a bacterium to develop in oysters that particular bacterium carries certain consequences. And this
but
court
it's
found
inherent in all oysters.
I do not understand that to be the decision, Your Honor.
Well,
it is inherent in all oysters.
That the bacterial presence occurs naturally.
I think that the direct analogy to be drawn here is the one that was drawn by the questions that your court asked. The court has been asking with respect to peanuts, or that could be asked with respect to strawberries.
Then you can argue that the case is wrongly decided, but I do think it's pretty close to this case.
It is either inconsistent. It is either wrongly decided or is distinguishable. I view it as distinguishable.
Why should it matter? Can you point us to something? Maybe there aren't any cases on this subject. There don't appear to be any cases one way or the other, not just that there aren't any cases. Why should it matter whether there's some additional ingredient or it's the food product itself, which is dangerous?
Because the courts have to draw a line as to where the legal duty starts and stops.
But why should they draw the line where you're drawing it?
Well, the restatement certainly so indicates.
Which part of the restatement are you referring to?
Well, I would refer to the fact that the restatement says that there's no duty.
Which section of the restatement are you looking at?
The second restatement of torts, section 402A, says there's no obligation.
Where?
It's comment J.
Along with you,
comment J, Your Honor.
Comment J. Yes, go ahead.
Talks about how there's no duty to warn diabetics about the consequences of exposure to sugar.
Yes, but then it goes on and say, where, however, the product contains an ingredient to which a substantial number of the population are allergic, an ingredient is one whose danger is not generally known, or if known is one which the consumer would reasonably not expect to find in the product, the seller is required to give warning against it.
Well, there are two limitations there. One is that it's an ingredient in the product.
Let's pause over that.
And the other is that it's an allergen. Neither of those apply.
This is not a requirement. This is an example of a situation in which there would be liability. There's nothing in that sentence that says it only applies to allergens.
Well, that's the Your Honor, that's the language that's used in the restatement second and the restatement second and third. Both are very specific in tying whatever requirement.
Neither of them say that only allergens are covered?
That's what they're saying on their face. If there is an allergen.
What words say only these are a series of examples. This is an example that's covered. It doesn't say it's the only thing that's covered. And
well,
obviously,
Your Honor, the restatement is defining the scope of the obligation, and they're defining the scope of the obligation.
Isn't your argument that it has to be an ingredient that is in the food or that presents the problem, not the food itself? That's the argument in your brief. How do you respond to Judge Garland's question? Is it necessary that it be a separate ingredient? Can it be the product itself?
No court has ever held that it can be the food itself.
And no court has ever held that it can't be.
Well, Your Honor.
Is that right?
Well, the Seventh Circuit, for example, ruled that there's no duty to warn about the consequences of exposure to alcohol.
But did they rule on it on the basis of it only applies to ingredients?
I don't believe that particular ruling turned on that.
Is your position that
on that basis,
that labels could be required of ice cream because milk is an ingredient of ice cream?
No, Your Honor, because milk is disclosed as being in the ice cream.
Well, that's a different question. It's not a question of whether it's disclosed. It is an ingredient, right? So your difference is not based on whether it's an ingredient.
I think if the product is labeled as milk or labeled as containing milk, that's as sufficient just as it is with respect to peanuts. And I think the point Your Honor made earlier is the right one. There are products out there whose consequences are far more extreme than the plaintiffs would ever claim with respect to milk because they can cause, for example, shock and even death. And peanuts would be a prime example.
As peculiar as it is that those items are so troublesome that people are expected to understand that there's a risk.
Well,
his argument, as I gather it, is that because lactose intolerance doesn't have anywhere near as dramatic an impact, it is less noticeable in the population as a whole.
I think that would be
strange.
I think that's a very perverse argument that the warning applies with respect to the least troublesome product, and I think that goes to the heart of the question. And it's not just, I mean, peanuts is an example. People probably know about something about allergies to peanuts. They certainly might not know what the full consequences are, but eggs, shellfish, strawberries, those can all cause shock, the same effect that peanuts can cause. And yet there is no warning as to the implications of exposure to any of those products. No court has found that to be necessary, and to the extent that the FDA has looked at those issues, the FDA has determined not to require
the sentence says that you're pointing us to. The seller may reasonably assume that those with common allergies, as for example to eggs or strawberries, will be aware of them, right? And he's not required to warn. What if it were the case that this was a common allergy as to which people are not aware?
But the statement is that someone may reasonably assume that people are aware. That's
that seems like an assumption that may apply in most cases, but not in a particular case.
But it is a sweeping grant to the
This is no grant. This is just a restatement of the law.
To the extent that the restatement is a reflection of the law, it is granting to the vendor the right to assume that people will be aware of these implications. But I also would urge, I think, obviously, a reflection of what actually has been the application of these requirements. With respect to the products I've named, with respect to the other products that can cause effects comparable to lactose intolerance, such as eating beans or broccoli or asparagus, which are all set forth in our brief. These are all alleged to have precisely the same kinds of effect with respect to some portion of the population. And yet there is
it a fact question whether they have the same effect or not?
No, I think these are the no. I don't
it's
think
not?
So.
They disagree with you as to how much of an effect there is.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that if one takes as a given the effects that is described by the plaintiffs, there's no factual dispute.
Well, they use the word diarrhea, right? There are many kinds of diarrhea, some of which could cause death and some of which don't. So can we tell from the face of the complaint which kind of diarrhea we're speaking of?
Well, I think you can because there's no contention that this is diarrhea being caused by exposure to contaminated water or things of that nature that can cause that causes.
So your position is at least in part that the threshold harm isn't high enough here, right? That under the restatement there has to be, and then according to our case law, there has to be some combination of how often it occurs and how bad it is, and your view is it's not bad enough here.
My view is it's not bad enough, and my view is that you know it's not bad enough by examination not only of the various products that the restatement says there's no need to give a warning with respect to, aspirin, sugar, et cetera, and the fact that those products can cause death.
Suppose through a process of mutation, which we undergo all the time, it's developed that 10% of the population could die if they drank milk. Would your position change?
Well, given the fact that there's no requirement with respect to these other products, my expectation is the Food and Drug Administration might itself decide to do some of those conditions. I think if 3 to 6% of the population has allergies that can cause the more severe problems that we've discussed,
death,
and yet there's no requirement of a specific warning, then there would be no specific requirement there.
What was that again?
I don't know that there would be a common law obligation.
Oh, no.
There's no court has ever held there has to be an obligation with respect to peanuts. I believe that if there's if we assume that all the candy manufacturers in this country are in compliance with the law, notwithstanding the fact that they don't warn about the implications of eating peanuts, and yet their products contain peanuts, it seems to me that the analogy would apply. Nonetheless, that is a hypothetical.
Your theory, you buy the other side's theory that because people would die right and left when they drank milk, everybody would then be under that it was dangerous?
My view is that the law has recognized, and this is reflected in the Food Allergen Labeling and Consumer Protection Act of 2004, that was passed by Congress and is in place, that is sufficient with respect to even these severe products like peanuts, that there be a disclosure on the label of the presence of peanuts or whatever else.
So is your view that there under the common law duty to warn, there could never be a duty to warn about any food product?
Well, our view is that there is not a duty to warn about the consequences of being exposed to the inherent natural components of a food. That is our view.
So yes, that is our position. Answer to the question.
Yes, if that's the, I think my answer qualified somewhat the question, but as qualified, I'm answering it yes.
Why doesn't the restatement just say that? That would be a lot easier.
I think the restatement, if you look at the applications of it, it's how it's understood, and you know they give an interesting example. If you have oranges that you've dyed with something that's an allergen, then you have to disclose it. And yet there's no suggestion in the restatement that you have to disclose the fact that some people are allergic to oranges themselves, which they are, and it can cause eczema and hives, etc. Yet the restatement doesn't even contemplate the possibility that that's what you'd have to warn about. The only thing the restatement is concerned about, and they use that specific example, that's not an application, that's their example, is if you dyed the orange. A consumer wouldn't know you had done that. But there's no hint, no whiff of any suggestion in the restatement that you'd have to warn about the orange itself. With respect to the preemption issue.
On that, the section in question preempts state requirements for foods. separate provisions of the statute preempt state requirements for labeling.
Well,
so I don't understand your preemption argument.
All right, let me be specific here. There are Section 403 capital A of the Food and Drug Cosmetics Act has a lists a series of federal provisions that have preemptive effect. The very first one is with respect to standards of identity. And what it says is, and it's the most sweeping of all of the preemptive provisions, and I think this is critical going to the question you asked about what the intent was of Congress. If there is a standard of identity, and there's only a standard of identity for a minority of foods, but if there is a standard of identity for a food, and milk is one, then there can be no requirement for that food that is not identical to the standard of identity.
So let me just make sure I understand. All state labeling requirements are preempted for foods for which there's a standard of identity?
Unless it is identical to the standard of identity itself. That's correct. And let me say, that is what the regulation, you asked whether...
Why did they use the word food rather than labeling like they do in other provisions?
Because it's more sweeping.
Well, it'd be even more sweeping if they'd said labeling.
The regulations do say that, Your Honor, and someone asked...
The regulations do not get you where you're
trying
to go here.
Well, I think it does, Your Honor, because what the regulations say, and this is 21 CFR 100.1, it's 100.1 C4, it talks about a state regulation is subject to preemption because it is not identical to the requirements of the preemptive federal statutory provision or regulation, including a standard of identity. And then it goes on to define what that means. What does it mean not to be identical to? And this is critical. It says not identical to means the state requirement directly or indirectly imposes obligations or contains provisions concerning the composition or labeling of food.
Labeling about identity is the issue there,
well,
right?
The labeling required for standard of identity takes various forms.
Well, why don't we look at the... I guess both sides seem to be calling the section about safety an exception, but in fact, in the Act, it's labeled construction. And it says, shall not be construed to apply to a requirement respecting a statement about the labeling of food, provides a warning concerning the safety of the food, yeah, or a component of the food. Why isn't this labeling regarding the safety of the food?
Because the term safety, for yes, purposes of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act,
yeah,
has a meaning.
Yes, and the meaning is harm.
The meaning is harm.
Yeah.
Well, and harm has a definition, too.
And what is that definition?
The capacity to injure or otherwise damage the health of individuals.
Right. So it's alleged here that lactose intolerant, that somebody who's lactose intolerant and drinks milk is harmed.
What is alleged,
yeah,
is that a person who drinks milk,
yeah,
is subject to the possibility of bloating and other gastrointestinal discomforts.
Right. And, well,
no, I'm quoting from the warning that's being requested here.
Yes, that's fine. But they also claim that with respect to specific petitioners, they have diarrhea and other things like that. Isn't that a harm? You think diarrhea is not a harm? Is that your position?
Your Honor, it's the federal the Food and Drug Administration. Yes, to answer your question, the Food and Drug Administration, and the reason I can say yes,
yes,
with confidence,
yes,
is because the Food and Drug Administration, in the context of deciding whether or not it had legal authority to approve Olestra,
right,
was faced with exactly the same physical consequences of exposure.
In order to make that determination, they did extensive study, had extensive testimony, thought it was a very close question, and talked specifically about the kind of diarrhea, I'm reading from the opinion, experienced by the study subjects. Now, we don't know whether this kind of diarrhea is the same or not. I'm not that interested in hearing testimony today on this. But this, if anything, this sounds like the FDA is saying, in order to make a decision like this, we got to hear evidence. You want to do this without hearing evidence.
Well, what the FDA said is, we will assume, and not merely assume, confirm the accuracy of certain consequences of consumption of Olestra. The question that we then have to face is that a safety issue? If it is a safety issue, they can't approve it.
No, you're not following Judge Garland's question.
Well,
how can we, as a matter of law, state that there is no safety concerns when there's an allegation of serious diarrhea?
Well,
how can we possibly say that without considering carefully the kind of evidence? I mean, a certain number of people are probably going to die from excessive diarrhea because you can lose too much fluid.
Well, there's no allegation in the complaint that.
We don't know. We don't know how serious.
I think the plaintiffs have an obligation to put forth.
Sure, they do, but not in the complaint.
Well, the relief that the plaintiffs seek is one that describes the implications as being gastrointestinal discomfort. That's ultimately the phraseology they use. Now, they do talk about bloating, diarrhea, et cetera, or other gastrointestinal discomfort. I think one can reasonably take as a given that these are the kinds of implications that they are alleging are the consequence of exposure to this product.
Counsel, and your argument that this doesn't indicate safety is, to say the least, counterintuitive.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's counterintuitive because it's against the backdrop of the Food and Drug Administration's careful consideration of exactly what that term means.
Well, can I ask you, look, the warning that they're asking for is if you experience diarrhea or stomach cramps, you may be lactose intolerant, right? One of the things is diarrhea. And in the Olestra analysis, the agency said that the volume of available safety evidence for Olestra is enormous, all of which FDA was obligated to review, evaluate, and synthesize before making its decision. It then did that, looked at that large volume of material, and concluded that in the case of Olestra, it wasn't significant enough. That is the harm. But that seems pretty fact-specific about the particular kinds of symptoms that you get when you do a particular, you consume a particular kind of food, or in this case, chemical.
Well, I believe that when one reviews the Olestra decision-making.
I've reviewed it.
Yes, and one finds that diarrhea is one of the effects that was.
But it's a particular kind of diarrhea caused. Isn't that right? Well, you don't think that they didn't evaluate the kind of diarrhea that Olestra caused, do you?
I don't think they didn't confront that, and I don't think there's any allegation in the complaint
You don't think that in the Olestra case they confronted that?
Oh, I think they did confront it.
Right.
That's what I meant to say.
Yes.
I think they did confront it. But I also think that when one compares what they concluded to what the plaintiffs allege here, I believe they are coterminous. Okay. And it is on that basis that one can reasonably conclude that these are not safety concerns.
Is there any indication in the legislative history, the Senate reports, that the preemption scope would depend on the level of harm alleged or the level of harm caused by the product? I mean, I thought there was blanket statements in the background of this legislation that just said state requirements with respect to safety would not be preempted.
Well, that's the language used in the what we've called the exception.
Right. I'm asking is, was there any further discussion that suggested that there would be different levels of harm that would trigger the preemption requirement, or was it just the blanket statements that I've indicated?
Well, I think it's the blanket statements, but the question then becomes, what does the term safety mean under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act? And that is what the Olestra example helps elucidate, and that's why we've relied upon it.
Okay, thank you. Rebuttal? I think you're out of time, right? We'll give you two minutes.
Your Honor, 1 minute. Just to make sure I answer Judge Silverman's question about the cause of action under D.C. law, it seems to me that all we're saying is that the district court acted precipitously here. Before having full information about the extent to which the public does not understand this risk, the extent to which the sellers understand that they're selling to a population that doesn't understand this risk, the extent to which this is a true safety matter, that while
Can I just pause on that last thing? What do you mean a population that doesn't understand?
Excuse me?
Something special about the District of Columbia in that regard?
No, we believe that this is a nationwide problem. We think it's unusual in the district in the sense that they know their population is majority lactose intolerance, where nationwide their that would be a minority. But in the district, they're selling to a majority of consumers who are lactose intolerant. All the people in the lactose intolerance group are going to transition over the course of their lives from being lactose tolerant to being lactose intolerant.
And so a majority of the district population is going to go through this transition at varying times and with varying degrees of pain and suffering. These are the allegations.
And is your allegation, I assume you're suggesting that there is a racial connection to the lactose intolerance.
Well, genetics. So there is a, it is.
Why do you assert that, what is it in your allegation that indicates the explanation as to why you assert the majority of D.C. residents are lactose intolerant?
What we do is we cite the census, we cite the scientific.
I just want to hear your allegation. What is the allegation that the majority of D.C. residents are lactose intolerant? What is the reason for that?
The reason for that is that it's like 60 or 70% of African Americans are lactose intolerant. 90% of Asians and Native Americans are. So we applied those against the census figures.
You asked for $100,000 in damages, or is it damages or something else?
No, it would be pain and suffering just for the named plaintiffs, just to make the point that this is real harm.
That's the amount of your real harm?
That's the amount of the named plaintiffs' real harm. It's an amount less than $100,000.
Right. And there's ten plaintiffs?
With 10, yeah.
Or
I
so.
Think it is, something like that. And the idea is just to make, this is obviously an amount that would be entirely insignificant to the defendants here. It's just to make the point this is real harm occurring to real people in the district every day.
But on the measure of how much harm might be required, it's not very much harm. So if what would you say to the question of whether this passes a threshold of the amount of harm required before warnings are required?
Well, I think that if I would look to the Alestra decision as, that's what the FDA thought was needed.
I'm not talking about preemption. I'm sorry. I'm on the common law tort.
I think with a common law tort, obviously, there is no threshold for injury. I mean, pain and suffering is compensable to the extent that a jury believes it's real.
I'm sorry. I'm still not being clear. Okay. Our cases say that there has to be sufficient harm before you can get a duty to, before there can be a negligent duty to warn.
Right, because the harm has to be sufficient that a reasonable vendor would warn.
Right.
So what we believe that people going through months of this kind of pain and discomfort and just think of the distraction.
Let me ask you a question. Are you aware of any food product at all that doesn't cause an allergic reaction on the part of somebody, or some citizen? Are you aware of any food product?
Well, I don't think I would say, for example, water is. No one's allergic to water. There are a lot of substances that, as far as I know,
there are a large number. Are you aware of any food product that doesn't cause allergy to someone?
I guess I don't know. Let me assume, for purposes of your question, that they all cause some allergies to some people, and I think the distinction you have to make is between those allergies that are so idiosyncratic that it wouldn't be reasonable for a vendor, if, for example, nectarines, which I've never heard of as being causing anybody allergies, but assume that one in a million persons would have a mild allergic reaction to a nectarine. I don't think a vendor could reasonably ask to put a label on every nectarine they sell under those circumstances. On the other hand, if it was one in 100,000 and that one in 100,000 died, then so it seems to me that there is a weighing process.
So any case brought against any food product would have to take evidence to determine how many people had an allergic reaction and what was the seriousness of the allergic reaction.
I think you would have to be able to allege in your complaint in this court, Rule 11 standards. You'd have to have a good faith basis in fact and in science to show that the product was an allergen or had similar effects as an allergen would, and that a significant number of how many people were affected, and whether or not a reasonable vendor with the scientific understanding that they're charged with would give the consumer information about that so they could make a reasoned choice. I'm going to buy and consume this, or I'm going to leave this alone and do something else.
Which cases have covered food products and found a duty to warn?
Just from the food product itself?
Just any food case. I mean, your opponent says there are no cases where duty to warn has been imposed with respect to a food.
My recollection
right? There are none?
I don't my colleague is right with the exception of the oyster case.
The oysters
I agree with Your Honor's reading of the oyster case. But aside from the oyster case, I think that's right. I think my colleague is right that there is no case that targets a food per food that is a food in its natural ordinary state, we would just argue that lactose intolerance is not an allergy. It requires a different analysis. If on a full record the district court decided that, you know, warnings were not required, then his findings would be entitled to deference in a way that his decisions on these papers is not.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Call the next case.